We're not trying to opportunistically scale aggressively and then sell to the highest bidder. We're trying to create intergenerational wealth for a much broader audience. For us, we will never detach ourselves from the mission of what we're doing. We certainly will pivot, and how we execute and demonstrate that mission might look very different over time, but at the core, fundamentally, the things that we cared about from day zero are the things we'll care about day 1 million and two.
This is the Righteous Capitalist Podcast, hosted by Doug Zacher. How we make money matters.
Hey, right now, I don't know if you're on a road trip to see a friend or family member you haven't seen in over a year, because, well, you know, or if you're doing something else for the first time in a long time, because, well, yeah, there's that. What I do know is that you're listening to The Righteous Capitalists. I'm your host, Doug Zacher, and I want to thank you for letting us join you in whatever it is you're doing. And speaking of doing things for the first time in a long time, I'm sitting here face to face and seeing today's Righteous Capitalist, Marvin Francois from the live streaming e-commerce startup Twine, smiling right in front of me. Can you tell I'm a little excited to get back to doing interviews how they were intended, in person? And what better way to get back into in-person interviews than with Marvin, who is one of our Righteous Capitalists in residence? If you think of your usual podcast guest as a one-and-done kind of thing, our Righteous Capitalists in residence are the complete opposite. They have so much insight and their businesses are so revolutionary that we bring them back to talk about where their businesses are in their evolution and their views on things going on around us. What we don't do is rehash and redo what we've already spoken about. So, if you want to know about the conception of Twine and its parent company, Onekin, and how it was born from a need to change the status quo of Black business, access to capital, and exposure in the marketplace, you need to listen to our first episode with Marvin, which is episode 25. When last we spoke with Marvin, him and his partners were building Twine and raising capital, all while still running Onekin, an e-commerce marketplace for Black creators and Black-owned businesses. I want to say welcome back to the podcast, but really, I should say thank you for having me in your apartment in Queens for this interview.
Always my pleasure.
So I guess the one thing we will review, we won't go back in time and back in history and review the inception of Onekin and Twine. Sure. However, for those tuning in to you for the first time, it would probably help for them to just know what Onekin is. Sure. And what Twine is.
So Onekin, the umbrella slash parent company of Twine, which started off as an idea 5 or 6 years ago, it's in simple terms, it's a retail tech startup. And we have a hyper focus on supporting small businesses in general, with a particular focus on BIPOC small businesses. Those are traditionally disenfranchised and lacking access to capital, but also visibility and support from the larger marketplace. Onekin was, in many ways, the idea that we could, in some way, through small business, harness the collective genius and creativity and resourcefulness of our community and create tangible products and solutions that would catalyze economic change in disenfranchised neighborhoods. And that was that case study translated itself into some tangible products, the marketplace, and then ultimately Twine, which we're unveiling this summer, which I'm excited to talk more about.
So Onekin is an effort to provide a solution to the fact that Black entrepreneurs and Black consumers have been getting screwed for decades.
Yeah. And that's a high level. And we think about it a bit more comprehensively because we're trying to cover kind of BIPOC small businesses in general.
Right.
But in simplest terms, that's exactly right. You know, we were sitting on the sidelines for such a long time thinking about all the ways in which we could be providing support. And at the very beginning, we were kind of thinking about leveraging our collective expertise to offer some type of advisory product for small businesses. And then it became abundantly clear to us that we needed to have a more immediate and tangible impact.
And if you want to know more about that history, Marvin and I talk all about that in that first episode, yep. So you should take a jump back.
Yep.
So then there's Twine, yeah. Which is a, I've been trying to make sure
that
I could say this right every single time. It is a live stream e-commerce, wait, but I missed the word social. Isn't the word social in there somewhere?
That's totally fine.
All right, what is, how is Twine defined in the marketplace right
that's,
now?
That's a great question, and the reality is the marketplace kind of readjusts its perspective on what a product like this looks like. So, we call it the live stream social commerce.
That's it, app. Live stream social commerce.
Yeah, so we want to leverage our community and bring in this product to life. So we want to additionally introduce elements of supporting small businesses, but also supporting small businesses that have the local intimate personalization element to it. So I think last year in particular, 2020, people suddenly became super conscious about the significance of shopping small and more precisely shopping local. So we're effectively through this product trying to make shopping local accessible nationwide, which probably on the surface sounds like an oxymoron. But as we dig into it a bit more, I'm sure it'll become more apparent what that means.
So if anyone's ever seen Amazon Live, they do something similar. There are a couple competitors. There's one called Network.
Yeah.
There's one called, which I liked.
Yeah.
There's Talk Shop Live, which I also liked, which coincidentally, or not coincidentally, were both founded and headed by white men.
Mm-hmm.
So you could guess who's on there and what's on there.
Yep.
Talk Shop Live seems to be very celebrity driven.
Yeah.
And then two others that I found are Pop Shop Live and Shop Shops.
Yeah. You've mentioned a few of them. There's actually last year and certainly the start of this year, there was kind of this emergence of a number of live stream shopping apps. The word competitor is interesting for a few reasons. And certainly when I think about competition or comparables, there's certainly the direct and indirect comparables, if you will. So those ones that you mentioned, there is this specific focus on what is now termed shoppertainment. So yeah, I know. It's a real thing. So that is, it's the intersection of shopping and entertainment. So their goal is to entertain you and their goal is to get you to buy a t-shirt for $300. So it appeals to a very specific demographic, and it also serves a very specific audience. We're different in that we are genuinely hyper-focused on small businesses. And at the very beginning, we were certainly focused on BIPOC small businesses because that was the space where we had done much of our work in our early years. And as we started to develop this product and bring it to life, we saw the broad application across the small business universe. So then we said to ourselves, from a strategic perspective, it makes sense to start small and start BIPOC, but certainly we want this product to be available to all small businesses because we think everyone can benefit from this. So with the small business focus, what we're trying to do is, especially in the very beginning, hyper-focus on those communities that don't have a lot of visibility and a lot of access. And we're not here to try to entertain audiences. We're here to bring significant traction to small businesses in remote neighborhoods and communities, or in historically disenfranchised neighborhoods and communities. I was in Tulsa, and I went into Tulsa with this thesis. I went into Tulsa kind of with this ambition and idea about what I wanted to get out of this experience. And I came away with that and a million more things. And as I started to meet with local government officials and private sector and investors, I also saw the potential for Twine to catalyze local tourism. I was sitting at this, there was this sneaker shop. Amazing. It's called Silhouette. It's right on Black Wall Street at the intersection of Archer and Greenwood. And I met with the owner, Koo, who is absolutely amazing. And so she has these like exclusive sneakers on the wall. She has local art on the wall. She has this cool apparel, like locally made apparel. And then she also, that night, she had an event. It was attached to some social justice campaign around a guy who was on death row in Oklahoma City. And they had local artists come and perform. And I'm like, in this small little space, I'm seeing so much of this wonderful city. I'm seeing the fashion. I'm seeing the art. I'm seeing the music. And it's a shame to me that no one else can see this, that no one else is seeing this in real time. And it just dawned on me that we have the potential with this app to expose the fashion, the art, the music, the culture of these remote communities that no one knows about. And then suddenly you have something really impactful happening. not only are people buying in real time products on our app, but then they then say to themselves, wait, why am I not planning a trip to Tulsa next week or next month? Mm-hmm. And so again, we're operating in this competitive landscape where shoppertainment is kind of prevailing. But again, our goal isn't shoppertainment. Our goal is local level impact.
It sounds like, I want to use the word engage rather than entertain.
That's exactly right. You know, I have all these apps on my phone, and objectively, they're doing great. Beautiful user experience. There's a certain cachet and exclusivity attached to it. They have some heavy hitter investors behind them, you know, Drake, et cetera, you name it. And they also have influencers that are doing kind of the work of getting people excited about buying a product. Influencers who are otherwise super detached from what it actually means to like support or patronize a local business. What I love about what we're doing is two things. From a technology perspective, we're taking a really big risk. A lot of those other apps have pre-loaded streams, pre-recorded streams. We're gonna bring you a live stream experience. And I'm talking like a genuine, like it's happening right now. It's not getting recorded. If you don't get it now, you're not gonna get it. You have to. And what we're doing then is also giving people real-time access to small businesses. More precisely, if you have a question that you need to ask the vendor, we have this chat feature. You can talk to the vendor, and in real time, they're going to be responding to you, person in Oakland, to you, person in Atlanta, to you, person in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. In real time, you're going to be getting some real-time responses to your questions. And so that's the one piece. The other piece is, I was once again on Black Wall Street, and I was popping in and out of different shops, and just with this year being the centennial, there's a lot of amazing things happening there locally. But what was most impactful to me was being able to talk to people who had grown up in Tulsa and who intergenerationally had invested and reinvested in the neighborhood. And I was talking to this one guy, his name is Cleo, such an amazing person. And he had developed this apparel print shop. And I was visiting him in his operations, and he had his three little nieces there who were watching him in real time build this business from scratch. He talked about how he couldn't afford to pay the $500 rent when he started. And, you know, last year he generated six figures.
Wow.
Yeah. And having his family be there in real time, witnessing what it means and what it looks like to build a business from scratch with limited support. And his niece was kind of doing a show and tell. And one of the things that she mentioned she was most excited about was seeing her uncle build a business from scratch. And so with our app, those are the stories that you're going to get in real time. We can't manufacture that. We can't make that up. You're going to get the real authentic local experience.
It sounds like you are grabbing the kind of the best of everything, right? You're grabbing the best of Amazon. And there is some good there, right? I mean, Amazon's marketplace theoretically was supposed to democratize retail, yet they charge people exorbitant amounts for rankings, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it is the farthest thing from a democratized marketplace. Yeah. But you are very much that marketplace, the promise of that marketplace, bringing in small entrepreneurs. In case our listeners haven't discovered this yet or didn't notice, Twine, you can't get on Twine anywhere. Twine is currently being built. So how's that going?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. It is currently being built. The idea for Twine came up probably a year and a half ago. And then we started, especially with kind of COVID accelerating the decline of traditional retail, we started putting pen to paper probably the spring of last year. And then we started to do some diligence around, okay, you know, what are the technological requirements and how do we get there? And so by the time we met in the fall, we had a tech team, and then probably a week later, we lost our tech team.
No way.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, and it, mind you, it took us several months to even secure that partnership. And so we lost our tech team. And
you lost them. I mean, you don't need to tell us the whole sordid story. Like, did they go under? Like, what was the?
So we're a super lean startup. You know, there's only two of us, and we needed to outsource a lot of our heavy technical development until we could afford to hire a tech lead. We were fortunate to find a team in the Ukraine, and they decided that, you know, they had bigger ticket items to focus on.
All right.
And so then, probably a week after you and I had spoken, we had lost our team. And so there was this moment of, gosh, we got to produce this product. We got to unveil it by Black Friday. And, you know, we have the designs done. We have kind of the rollout strategy, but we don't have a team. How are we going to do this? And after searching in Argentina and India on the West Coast, we finally we found a team in the Ukraine again, who was the perfect partnership. So then we officially broke ground on development sometime in mid-October, which was probably already 5 months behind schedule, but that's the nature of these things.
Right.
Yeah. So then we started developing it, and we had this super aggressive ask, like, we need all these bells and whistles by Black Friday. And we had the reality check of saying, well, that's you know, not even feasible. That's not practical. So then we watered down our ask to get something a bit more tangible by Black Friday. Needless to say, it didn't launch by Black Friday. The nature of this space is that any and everything that can potentially go wrong will most certainly go wrong. Mm-hmm. And certainly we've had that experience, but it gave us an opportunity to slow down a bit and to think about the product that we wanted to produce. And while we were getting a lot of external pressure from prospective investors saying, do this now, buy Black Friday, or we can't write a check, we had to take a step back and say, is it more important for us to get a check really quickly and produce a half-baked, ill-conceived product? Or do we want to be very thoughtful about what we introduce into the world? So we opted out of the checks by Black Friday and said, let's spend the next several months really thinking about what this looks like. And more importantly, let's start to enlist the support of our community, of vendors and customers, to assess what it is they want to see. So with that, it gave us space to develop kind of this 18 to 24 month product rollout map, where we have this fully baked, fully optimized bells and whistles app that's going to be exceptional and beautiful. But then concurrently, we have this beta version of the app, which is super bare bones. Like, it does the basic things that a live stream app should do. That's what we're bringing to the world this summer. That's what we're introducing to a local market this summer, with the intent of having people, you know, interact with it, break it, and then allow those early learnings to inform what the rollout looks like. So not out yet. We are 90% complete. It's literally actively being beta tested as we speak.
Wow, that's incredible.
It's exciting.
And that was 7 months ago that we
We
spoke, which, you know, 7 months in is both a long time and nothing when you're starting a company.
Well, it's certainly nothing when there's so many things to do. When there are a million things to do, 7 months is, you know, it's a blink. Mm-hmm. There were certainly moments where we had to be objective and honest with ourselves about, like, what's the competitive landscape looking like now? What are our peers, quote unquote peers, doing? And what does that mean in terms of how we need to be thinking about what our product looks like? And so it's the balance between staying true to yourself and authentic about what it is you want your product to be, while also being mindful that there's this space where, you know, consumers require a certain experience, and you have to kind of honor that and adhere to it.
Right. And what's the talk about all these live streaming e-commerce social apps, right? I mean, are people trying to become the next Amazon?
Yeah, we certainly have peers in the space who want to overtake Amazon. I think that's a noble ambition. That's not precisely our goal. That feels very self-serving. And the reality is, we don't have to overtake Amazon to have the impact that we need to have. So we're not really distracted by that noble, but admittedly sometimes vain ambition. For us, we were very deliberate about creating an app, a product that could have multiple use cases. And while we were certainly starting off hyper-focused on small businesses and retail more precisely, already and organically, we're seeing how I was talking to a couple incubators and investors, and they were like, yeah, people could be using this for crowdfunding campaigns. People could be using this for local tourism. People could be using this for, you name it, purposes. And that's exciting, that people are not only seeing the vision, but also how it could be applied across spaces. And that was by design for us. I think one thing that our team, you know, we anchor ourselves on is, tangibly speaking, are we doing what we set out to do? I think about the economics of this product. You know, we are displacing some markets, some spaces. I think about the fact that we're going to be able to cut down operating costs significantly for small businesses. So you have that one dynamic working. The other dynamic that's also really exciting is that we're going to be able to multiply conversion rates by multiples, but significantly. Some early data tells us that in the space, some of the high performing live stream apps are doing, you know, 20% plus conversion rates, which is astronomical.
Conversion rate being people who sign on actually purchase something. Is that
that's exactly right. So it's so if for example, 100 people visit your site, and then two buy products, then that's a 2% conversion rate. So we have these two dynamics working together. It's the combination of being able to reduce costs for small businesses, but also multiply their conversion rate significantly. That for me translates to that economic and local level impact that we've set out to have in the very beginning. If I can give you more money in your pocket, if I can help you reduce your costs, then suddenly you have this sustainability model that lets you hire locally, lets you reinvest in your business, but it also addresses something else that we haven't talked enough about, which is the funding chasm that exists. You know, they call it a funding gap, which is such a cute phrase, but the reality is it's a chasm. The fact that BIPOC small businesses, especially those that are of venture quality, are still struggling to get access to capital, despite otherwise being overly qualified for capital. Right. So what we're solving for is, well, we know you're struggling to get access to bank financing. We know you're struggling to get access to venture funding. What if we can help you from the very beginning to operate more cost effectively and efficiently and increase, you know, increase your margins? Then suddenly you don't need that immediate injection up front. Suddenly you have the runway to build a business self-sufficiently, and operate to then position yourselves for venture funding at some future date.
Right. So you just mentioned concern about displacing certain people. Who are you talking about there?
In the past, you know, a lot of solopreneurs and kind of black and brown owned retail shops, they would attend these pop-up markets. They would attend these kind of trade shows, trade fairs, bazaars, you call it. As a local Brooklyn-based small business, I know there are wonderful pop-up markets in Atlanta and Boston and Oakland and you name it, in Texas. And for me to access that audience, I'm going to travel there. I'm going to travel to all these places. I'm going to get that visibility and I'm going to do well. And our data tells us that at least for our initial target market, you know, our vendors are making upwards of 90% of their annual revenue from these experiences. And so it certainly justifies the visit. But the flip side of that equation is it's costing them, you know, anywhere from 60 to 80% of their annual revenue to even participate. It's the combination of having to travel all across the country to get access to your target audience, having to ship your team out there, having to ship products out there, and also having to pay these exorbitant upfront fees to even participate. And so at the end of the day, that just doesn't translate to a sustainable model. So while it isn't our precise goal to displace pop-up markets, what we are trying to do is help small businesses operate efficiently and to scale up aggressively. So if a byproduct of that effort is displacing pop-up markets, then it is unfortunate in some ways, but I think it is the inevitable direction that the industry is going in. What we're also trying to do is partner with them. We're trying to partner with some of these pop-up markets, especially the bigger named ones, and say, look, your model is hyper inefficient. And if your intention is genuinely to serve small businesses, then you should be leveraging our app to deliver this service. Mm-hmm. So we're hoping that they see it that way, that we can leverage technology to serve this demographic a lot better, rather than seeing us as kind of the antithesis of kind of their business model or their business venture.
Right. Well, I can't commend you guys more for at the very least acknowledging yep. who you're displacing, because every technology displaces someone.
Sure.
And we've seen how much that hurts real people and lots of people. And yet there's never, that's just the price of, right? That's just the price of change.
Yeah.
But I personally believe there's a real need to think about that. It's amazing that you've given it thought.
Yeah.
You've even reached out.
Absolutely.
To people. But at the same time, if you think about it, the people that are being displaced, and I don't want to minimize at all what they do, but how many people in the end ran those markets?
Yeah.
It's probably a handful of people total
yeah.
that were benefiting from those markets. And some, you know about those markets better than yeah. I do, about who runs them,
sure.
who was making the money, where right. the money was going, where the wealth is, and who is building the wealth
yeah.
based on these markets. And my guess is that it wasn't the BIPOC community that was generating a lot of wealth from these pop-up markets. If you're the founder of it or creator, my guess is those people were generating some decent amount of wealth.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And we have the opportunity to the point that you're making to kind of spread the wealth. But I just think about kind of this idea that we just concentrate so much wealth in a few hands, when the reality is if we better distributed wealth, we could all be doing a lot better. And so I just think about all these ways in which we're failing to distribute the wealth. And the reality is, from a purely capitalistic perspective, it's actually damaging. If you cared about nothing else, if all you cared about was the potential to make more money, then you make more money by giving more people access to wealth creation.
Right. So speaking of access to capital, can you fill us in some on, on the quest to raise capital? Ooh. I mean, Twine can't be cheap.
As a kind of precursor to answering your question around how the fundraising is going, Jennifer and I have been pitching aggressively and everywhere. We've probably, between pitches and applications, she and I collectively have at least seen 100 of these. And I'm not exaggerating, at least 100.
Applications
like for funding, for grants, for accelerators, okay. Right. For kind of some of the bigger known accelerators in the world. And we had this really interesting encounter. And mind you, Jennifer and I, we knew what we were getting into as, Black and brown founders when we entered this space. And it was this one encounter in particular that after the call, Jennifer and I had to pause and laugh at what just happened. So we were talking to this white male millennial who I'm super kind of observant and discerning. And, he jumps on the call and, he himself was a startup founder and he jumps on this call. He has kind of this demeanor. He was going to pitch this product to us. It wasn't very clear to us from the website what it was. And so we were like, let's just have a conversation about it.
Why was he pitching to you guys?
Well, because he wanted us to use his product.
Oh, got it.
He wanted us to use
on your back end somewhere.
Yeah.
Okay, got it.
And so Jennifer.
Let me just draw more. Sure. Because what I think lots of people are unaware of is that when you build something like Twine, yes, there's lots of kind of original coding in there, but it's also that coding is also involved in piecing together
absolutely.
All different
APIs,
right?
Absolutely,
right. So, like the button, right? There's something out there you could purchase the coding for a like button, right? And you're kind of piecing all that together, as much as you're creating original
absolutely.
Code.
You're exactly right. So he comes on, super button nubs, super entitled. And he sees kind of this black guy, this Latinx woman, and he presented as someone who was of some privilege. And so then the moment Jennifer and I opened our mouth and read off our credentials, you could almost see him cowering a little bit somewhat of a shift in his demeanor.
Wow.
Not entirely, but I think he had to recalibrate a little bit, like these aren't the average Joe. And so then he started talking through his product and he talked about how it was an idea on the back of the napkin and through grit and hard work, he was able to get $300,000 in two hard weeks. And then he talks about how then he got into, I'm not gonna say the name, but he got into one of the top two accelerators in the world with, again, an idea on the back of the envelope. And how that then translated to significant traction for him, and that in a matter of 3 hard months working exceptionally hard, he got $750,000 for his idea on the back of the envelope. And so I got super disengaged and I was like, okay, maybe this product isn't as basic as the website seems to suggest. So I wanted to give him space to talk through it. So I go, what am I missing here? So he started talking to the product, and again, without getting into details, not only did he have the money that he needed, but he also was able to hire a technically sound team for the next 2 years to build this product. And Doug, I'm not exaggerating. His product is, in simple terms, a model that I can build in 12 hours.
Wow.
And I wish I was exaggerating. His product is a model that I can build in 12 hours. And so we get off this call and Jennifer and I are just floored. We were just floored, and we were laughing about it. By this point, by the way, we had already produced six figures as a company on a 42-cent CAC, cost of customer acquisition. For context, that's about less than 1% of industry average.
I can imagine, right?
Amazon doesn't produce that CAC. Uh-huh. But we did. And despite the fact that we could demonstrate how well we operate, despite the fact that we were putting up six figures, we weren't getting the investors banging on our door saying, here's our check. But this guy with an idea on the back of the envelope for a product that I could build in 12 hours suddenly had $750,000 in three hard months.
Right. And you can imagine this is over drinks with friends, family.
Yeah. And it was friends and family, but it was also institutional investors who were behind this idea. And I was talking to a VC yesterday. It's a white woman who was super transparent and honest and gave me some really great feedback. And when I talked to her about our, you know, five-year projection, she goes, it's not aggressive enough. And I said, well, I got to be honest with you. Before I presented what I think is a more practical and a lot more aggressive five-year projection, but, you know, we got shut down for being impractical despite my ability to defend that projection. And she said to me, as a white female, she goes, I hope I'm not overstepping, but she goes, if you were a white male, you would not have gotten any objection.
To being so aggressive.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So it's the constant pushback that we get to, like, that's too aggressive. You're thinking too big. There's no way that this opportunity set is that big. When I'm a former banker, I live and I breathe models and data. If I'm presenting numbers to you, you better believe that I've researched and over-researched and over-researched 10 times over before I felt confident enough to say to you that in 5 years, we're going to make $100 million.
Mm-hmm. Is it an acknowledgement of their own bullshit? Because the first time I ever wrote a business plan, I was amazed at how much you just make this shit up. I mean, you said it yourself. You do research. You do all these things.
Yeah.
But in the end, you're just making logical assumptions,
yeah.
Right? So, based in nothing except sort of A plus B plus something, yeah. Some unknown we believe equals C. So right there, to give one group of people credit for being aggressive and buying into their numbers,
yeah.
And then taking another group and being like, you're too aggressive,
yeah.
To me just sort of shows how much it's all just sort of BS.
It really is. And to be clear, Jennifer and I don't have the luxury of making numbers up. So I've rebuilt the model at least 20 times. And I remember the early numbers, even Jennifer was like, wait a minute, these numbers look a little aggressive. Can you walk me through it? And so it was kind of that interplay of, you know, Jennifer giving me honest feedback saying, how do we defend this? And our spending the month saying, we can defend this with precise data points. Because again, we don't have the luxury of being aggressive without being able to precisely defend every data point. So it wasn't until we got to a point of being able to precisely defend every data point that we went out to the market saying, yeah, this is our projection, but we can defend this. Mm-hmm. Whereas to the point that you're making on the other side of the table, you can be aggressive and not have a strong defense for it, but you're going to be celebrated for being ambitious. We have the additional onus of having to do, and we knew this from the beginning, having to do the additional homework, but still not getting the credit for that. Like, right. we get quickly dismissed. So it's been a blessing more than it has been a curse for us, because I think Jennifer and I are probably 10 times smarter than we were this time last year. Wow. Because we've had to be. And ultimately, it's going to take the right investor to make that bet on us. But that investor is going to benefit from it exceptionally.
So have you been successful in raising
capital? So not as of yet. So this is entirely bootstrapped. Like, wow. Literally. So again, Jennifer and I are full-time founders. We're living on savings. We're investing in the business on savings. From the money that we're making from the marketplace, we're reinvesting in Twine. But this is entirely bootstrapped.
Wow.
We have, with the launch of the product in a couple months this summer, we have reinvigorated our fundraising efforts as of May 1st. With my being in Tulsa doing some pitching, we have objectively gotten a lot of support.
Since we last spoke, everyone seems to want to provide capital to BIPOC-founded companies. What's, I can only imagine you've seen behind the curtain of that.
There are a lot of funds that are now being launched saying, we're looking for the underestimated and the overlooked founder. And so I'm like, great, you're talking to us. Because I think 2019, you saw the launch of, we're looking for, you know, the underserved founder. And then 2020 was like, we're looking for the underestimated and the overlooked. And so then I'm like, okay, we've pitched to all of you. You all agreed that this is an exceptional product. And then we get this whole, let's see if you can bring it to market before we capitalize it. But then I'm telling you, we need capital to bring it to market effectively. And so then after the 101st rejection, I was like, well, who's out there serving the twice overlooked founder? Because that's what I feel like right now. You're all promising
and
that
super, yeah, and super underestimated.
Like I couldn't be, you know, Jennifer and I couldn't be more underestimated and more overlooked. Who's focused on that niche,
right,
of founders? And mind you, like I'm never coming into these spaces without having been like well researched, without having without being able to defend precisely how we're bringing this to the market and how we're going to return, you know, money to our investors. And more importantly, we now have a beta product. So now investors have something tangibly that they can touch and interact with and see that it does what we say it will do.
Right.
And so I'm just like, I don't know what else to say to you. I don't know what else to say to you who are looking for the underestimated and the overlooked.
Why not?
They don't provide feedback. We now have a former product engineer in VC on our board. He's been super honest and transparent about kind of what we need to be doing differently. And he's committed to work with us for the next 3 years until we get to Series A.
That's
and
great.
He's been super instrumental. Like he is the person that every tech startup should have on their board.
Wow. So considering he is your source of feedback, what's been...
What's
the feedback?
Well, he's been honest with us about how BS this process is. No, really, like, and because we had a conversation about valuation, and I said to him, I was like, look, I want to be very clear. While I bring to the table a lot of technical skills, you know, I'm a former banker, like I can build a model, I can talk about valuation pretty extensively. I also recognize that I'm new to this world, and so I'm open to feedback. I'm open to hearing constructively what it is we could be doing differently. We're hitting our heads against the wall on this valuation thing. But when I talk to a VC about our valuation and how I can defend that, when I get pushback, they never tell me why they're pushing back. And so then he goes, I got to be honest with you. The entire process is BS. If you are, you know, an early stage founder, your valuation has to be somewhere in the 3 to 5 million range. And I'm like, okay, I need data around that. I need, how do you defend that? And he goes, there is no defense for
it. Or back into it.
There is no defense for it. And he admits that the valuation process is entirely BS, but it's the industry that dictates this stuff. Mm-hmm. And so it's feedback like that that's helpful for me to kind of see kind of the space in which we're operating and to kind of calibrate accordingly. So I'm like, okay, as long as we all agree that this is a joke,
right?
You know, and that it doesn't matter how well researched we are, that we just have to kind of comply with this, you know, $3 to $5 million rule, and then sure, okay, we'll comply. Right. But it's that precise example that kind of translates itself across other areas. Like there are these hard and fast rules and expectations that VCs subscribe to, and that you have to adhere to, even if it's entirely bogus.
Which really makes it more of a culture than a
entirely,
business.
Entirely, 1,000%. Entirely.
Just admit it.
Just be honest, right, with me.
Willing to play along, yeah, willing to figure out what the culture is.
Right.
But just admit that we're talking cultural, please, things and rules without any basis versus trying to ground everything in business, right? Because
exactly,
in the end, you know, why are people getting screwed? Well, it's business, right? It's right. On the downside, it's always business. And
yeah,
yet,
whatever that means, yeah. Yeah.
And yet when they, you know, when they're in the driver's seat, it's really more culture than business.
That's entirely factual. That's right. And it, you know, as someone who was on Wall Street for like almost a decade, I know how to adhere to the prevailing culture. I know how to play the game.
Right.
You know, and you right. know,
just give me the rules.
Just give me the rules. Tell me how to play this game, and I'm gonna play it best. Mm-hmm. And you know, I was probably misguided in thinking that when I left Wall Street And then when I ventured into kind of tech entrepreneurship, that for the first time, I was going to have permission to be myself and to show up as myself in every single space. And needless to say, I've been proven wrong.
Wow. I feel like I can't avoid this question.
Sure.
How much of that culture do you think adheres to white culture versus black culture?
I think you know the answer to that. Obviously, white men kind of predominate the funding space. And needless to say, the portfolio companies in which they're investing, they reflect the identities of the funders. I speak to founders all the time. And one of the guys that I like a lot, one of my besties in the kind of founder tech universe, he has this education artificial intelligence platform that is literally giving Google a run for its money. And so he shows up to meetings like he's from Jersey, you know, he's got a Jersey accent, he's fully bearded, and you know, unfortunately, when he walks into a room, there are 10 decisions already made about him based on his appearance. Right. And he talked about precisely one example where he was pitching his product to an investor, and the whole while the investor was just looking at his beard, and quite blatantly looking at his beard, like not making eye contact, just looking at his beard. And needless to say, the meeting didn't go well because the investor wasn't paying attention to the fact that he's creating this awesome technology and doing amazing work. So that's kind of part of the cultural element, like are not having the permission to step into the spaces and the rooms and kind of in ways that are authentic and mm-hmm. real for us. And as a result, that translating to whether or not, you know, our ideas are considered investable. And this is not to create any excuses for people, but I don't think people are keenly aware enough of how they present and how they come into spaces with their biases, and how that bias not only blinds them, but it informs their decision making. I think people genuinely believe that when they make decisions, that there is some objective business criteria that inform that decision making. But oftentimes, without realizing that even the quote unquote objective criteria are informed by some bias.
The hiring process is one that everyone constantly points to, right? Before you even get to an interview, there were all these biases that sort of fed into the system. And then forget about after that.
I have a story about that, actually. Yeah. That got me in trouble before. I like to call Wall Street the streets, just jokingly. But before I left the streets, I had this interaction with, obviously I'm not going to say any names, but with an executive director. And it turned out to be surprisingly, you know, illuminating for him. He was this kind of white male who we had this encounter, and I think he genuinely took something away from it. But I was having a meeting. It should have just been the meeting, but naturally, because there's this kind of cultural bro code, there was kind of this casual, like, oh, we're all hanging out, we're talking about Trump. By the way, 99.9% of the people in the room are highly supportive of Trump at the time. And so one guy, this white guy, is an outlier, and he talks about, you know, this was around the time that Brexit was happening and there were conversations around building the wall, and that was kind of predominating media streams. And he talked about how all of this was just informed by like racism. And so you can't say racism on Wall Street. You can't say that. Like if you say that, it's offensive, you're ill-informed, like you haven't done your homework, you're factually incorrect. Yeah, right. And so somehow, because they had developed this rapport with me, they invited me into this conversation saying, Marvin, this one guy is saying it's about racism, and you know, we think he's wrong. What's your perspective? And at the time I was reading the autobiography of Malcolm X. just for context.
I remember when I read that too.
So I was on fire about everything. And so I was my director at the time, the person I reported to directly, he was there, and I was expected to give a politically, you know, correct response. I was the only black guy there. So of course, like if we've gotten to this point of liking you, it's because you make us feel safe, which I realized was dangerous for me, that I had made super conservative, like blatantly Trump supporters comfortable. And so I decided I was gonna turn on the Malcolm X a little bit. But I did it in a way that I thought would be palatable. So I'll pitch it to you this way. And I'll let you objectively decide what you think is at play here. So, because one of the guys, like, it was, he goes, it's about sovereignty. You know, it's, you know, it's not racism. It's about sovereignty. We just kind of want our own. And so then I go, well, you know, if your sovereign goals and platforms somehow consistently have racist outcomes, then pardon me if I believe that the real intention here is to be xenophobic, is to be racist. So it, I could tell that that was kind of a punch in the gut for him, because he had to process that. It's like, despite what you say you are out to do, if right. you if the tangible outcomes look a specific way, then pardon me if I believe that the intention of this campaign is specifically what you're achieving. And so, because I felt like that wasn't precise enough for him, what I said to him was, look around the room. For the past 3 or 5 years, we've been saying that we care very much about diversity and inclusion in hiring. And we've put all these programs in place. We've done all these marketing campaigns, but I'm the only black guy here. So pardon me if I believe,
right.
just based on output, that the policies that we're putting in place are inherently exclusive and racist. And so he, so my director was upset with my response. He walked off. He was like, this is unacceptable. But this guy was like, you've given me a lot to think about. He was like, I don't like that response, but he was like, I have to sit on that. And we've had a wonderful relationship ever since.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah. Because I gave him something tangible that he had to objectively see and admit for himself, like, that what we say we care about is in conflict with what we're actually doing.
Welcome to the theme of this podcast. So you had mentioned a meeting you had with a potential funder who asked whether or not you are going to become the next Amazon, right? Is that the way you put it?
Yeah, that's well, what they said was, what's your exit strategy? Oh, do you want to be acquired by Amazon or Facebook?
To which your response
I said,
was,
no, of course not. That's not what we're here to do. And I was like, you know, we're super ambitious. Like, we want to hold on to this forever, and we want to intergenerationally pass this along to our families, to our community. And something interesting to note is that part of our fundraising strategy is to include people in our community to be a part of this. So we're looking to do kind of the traditional, like, VC, like, or angel. We're also looking to carve out some space where everyday folks can actually have a piece of the company. There's a lot of regulatory shifts that are making that possible. Not to go off on too far of a tangent, but when I think about kind of the early investors in Facebook and, you know, Amazon and Uber, Doug, you wouldn't believe me if I told you that some people were checks as small as $5,000-$10,000, and now they're millionaires.
Right.
And so I think about how the wealth gap gets perpetuated by these supposed policies that are meant to protect people, but in fact exclude people from, like, aggressive wealth creation opportunities. Like these policies that say you have to make, you know, XYZ million dollars or XYZ minimally a year, and you have to have this much in savings or this much in net worth to even qualify to write a $5,000 check in the next big venture idea.
Yeah, I've seen,
like,
that.
Like, an everyday person probably has $5,000 to invest in an idea.
Mm-hmm.
Like, why can't they write a check for this and become millionaires in, you know, 5 or 10 years?
Right.
And so
right.
there's a lot of regulatory
right.
shift.
And not have $2 million in assets.
Yeah, and not have $2 million in assets.
Right.
People who make $75,000 a year can save enough money over time to write a $10,000. Why exclude them from these opportunities?
Right, right. And they're not so dumb to think that this is a guarantee.
No,
right?
Exactly.
Nobody is, but heck.
No one is.
I mean, I listen to what you guys want to do, and...
Yeah. I think it's a good idea. I think you're the right people to do it. I'm going to write you a check because I believe
right.
in you.
I mean, that is it. You talk to most investors... And that's what they're going on.
Of course. They're not going on some hard science.
Right. They're going on who's doing it, which again goes back to the whether you're aggressive or not aggressive, who gives a fuck?
Exactly.
Right? Is it a spectacularly scalable product? These days it has to be scalable, right?
Yeah.
For if you're gonna
Absolutely.
And are the people that I'm talking to right now, can they pull it off?
Yeah.
That is it. Those are the two questions.
Literally. Literally. They may throw 20 at you, but the two they actually care about are those two. And so part of what we're trying to do is take advantage of kind of the regulatory shifts and make it available to a much broader audience. But to get back to your original question, so the pitch was, you know, exit strategy, it has to be like an Amazon, it has to be a Facebook/Instagram. And if you don't, they're going to crush you. So I kind of rejected that assessment and I said, no, this is not what we're trying to build. Again, we're not trying to opportunistically scale aggressively and then sell to the highest bidder. We're trying to create intergenerational wealth for a much broader audience. And for us, exit means IPO for us. We're going to hold on to this forever. And so I got pushback saying that's ridiculous. And like, maybe you're right, but I don't think you're right. And so then I pivoted my response a bit just to ensure this person that I wasn't being kind of this idealistic idiot who wasn't thinking about this objectively. What I said to him was, even if you don't subscribe to, our IPOing and think the bigger guys are going to crush us, I'll tell you quite plainly, the opportunity set is so large that even if we acquired only 1% market share, and objectively, I think we're going to do a lot better than that, but even if we acquired only 1% market share, we can still return to our investors a significant sum on a risk-adjusted basis. We can still crush this. And so that's kind of the message to folks who are saying, sell out to the bigger players. Like that's the exit strategy. For us, we will never detach ourselves from the mission of what we're doing. We certainly will pivot, and how we execute and demonstrate that mission might look very different over time. But at the core, fundamentally, the things that we cared about from day zero are the things we'll care about, in day 1 million and two.
The business model of building something that could be great to then sell it to one of these monopolies, that's what's gotten us to where we are right now. That's added to the wealth divide and the income gap and all that.
Yeah, I think people are afraid, especially VCs, if I can just be honest, and I probably shouldn't be saying all of this because we're fundraising, but I gotta be honest. People are afraid to think independently and objectively. Of the thousands or so VCs or thousands of so VCs out there, I would say only the top 0.5% are actually originating ideas. They're the ones making the big decisions. And I say that because every time we talk to an investor, they're like, who else is investing? Who else are you talking to? Who's your lead investor? Okay, let us know when you get them to write a check because then we want to be on board. Right. So it's the sense of we need the main decision makers in the VC universe to validate this for us to get behind it. Right. And so we're finding ourselves encountering, groups of people who have a lot of money, but don't know what to do with it. So they rely on signals that say, if this person invested, then this must be an amazing idea. I've had people say objectively, like, this is one of the best, things that we've been presented, but I'm going to wait for this person to write a check.
Jeez. But think about it. I hadn't really thought about it in these terms before, right? I'm just taking a guess, right? I'm kind of talking out my ass here at the moment and making assumptions.
Yep.
But I would suspect that most of that money is held on or is held by people who happened to have gotten jobs at places that were early stage.
1,000%.
And they made more money than they would ever imagine to have made being an engineer or being a marketing person. Like, they were just going about their lives doing their jobs. And now they're gazillionaires. So it's not shocking that they don't really have an original thought, right? I mean, all they did was join a company that somebody else conceived of and envisioned, right? Yeah. So it's not all that surprising.
Yeah, it is unfortunate. And I want to be super objective and fair. There are some VCs that we've spoken to who get it, who are thought leaders. They're small, their funds may be small at the moment, but they are thought leaders and they're approaching this the right way. But I would say, unfortunately, the significant majority would be those who have a lot of money, but don't think about it independently and just wait for someone else to signal this is a good idea. Right. And part of, to the point that you're mentioning, like the VC that's on our board, he's been super transparent about this. He was like, look, you two are the brains behind this. And more importantly, like, we VCs, we just have the money. Like, we're not the originators of these amazing ideas. So when you're pitching, be mindful of the fact that you are, you're driving this. VCs are lucky to have you pitch this idea to them. That sometimes the power dynamic can be confused because we're coming to someone asking them for money. But the reality is, ideals are priceless. I think Jennifer and I have demonstrated that, you know, OneKin isn't a singular product. It's kind of this incubator of ideas that then translate to several products. That incubation is priceless.
Right.
And people should be knocking on our door, begging us to participate in that intellectual capital.
Mm-hmm. We know we're going to talk to you again.
Yeah.
Let's just say we talk again in 7 months.
Yep.
You said you're going to launch small.
Yep.
Over the summer. I imagine you will want to have, you know, raised some outside capital. Yep. By then.
Yep.
What else?
Yeah. So those are the two.
To do?
Those are the two goals. So launch small this summer, raise money, and then what we're looking to do with the product rollout, we're going to be doing a series of optimizations over the next 7 months. And hopefully by the next time we talk, we're trying to get the product available to the masses. Because again, this is something that we're starting small, but we think it has such broader impact.
Well, so cool. Well, I'm so excited for you. But thank you for having me here in Queens and getting me out of New Jersey.
I know. Welcome.
And across the river for the first time in over a year.
There you go.
So thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much, Doug. I really appreciate what you're doing. I feel lucky to be part of a group of like-minded folks who are in their respective industries and sectors having similar impact. So thank you for inviting me along this journey.
So in this episode, we not surprisingly talked a lot about bias. In editing it, I realized a big bias of mine, and that's a bias in favor of Marvin, his partner Jenny, and everything Twine can and will be. This bias led me to think so favorably of them that in two episodes with Marvin, I've neglected to ask just about the most basic question about a startup. And that's my job. I know if I was one of you listening out there and I became curious about the answer to this question, I would have started screaming in my car something like, "Ask the damn question already!" And that question is, how is Twine gonna make any money? Heck, in this episode, at one point, Marvin mentioned making $25 million in month 48 or something like that, and I just took it at face value because of the power of their ideas and my bias toward them. It would have been simple to just ask, how are you going to make that? If I was to get defensive about it, I could just say that I assumed that a retail platform would make money by charging a percent of all the sales on the site. But it's my job to ask these questions, so no matter what I or anyone else assumed, I've no excuse for not asking. I followed up with Marvin and asked. We'll certainly talk more about this in a future episode, but in short, Twine will earn revenue, yes, through a 5% commission on vendor sales, but they will also earn revenue through partnerships with enterprises that have a small business mandate, like the SBA and Amex. Over time, though, other meaningful revenue drivers will be ads and a revenue financing solution to help small businesses who traditionally lack access to bank financing meet short-term working capital needs. I think there's a lot in common between the bias that blinded me from asking this question and doing my job and the bias that hinders so many BIPOC founders from raising capital and seeing their vision become a reality. I hope Marvin's sincere storytelling enables lots of you out there to get a perspective you otherwise wouldn't have gotten and helps to alter your thinking and behavior. It's clear that many people can only be convinced by their own lived experiences or those of friends. A goal of this podcast is to bring those lived experiences to our listeners with the hope that it changes your perspectives and your actions within a company you're running or in your career in general. Additionally, I hope it changes your investing patterns, your hiring patterns, and enables you to see other people's struggles in a different light. If Marvin's stories don't persuade you, or somewhere in the back of your mind you're thinking, well, maybe their product just isn't that great, or maybe their presentation skills are lacking, or maybe it's something else, I'll ask you another question that I didn't ask because of my bias toward believing Marvin. Why is it that out of the $147 billion that flowed out of venture capital firms in 2020, only 3% went to Black founders? 3%! As Marvin said in this episode, I think we all know the answer to that question. The question that still remains, though, is what are we going to do about it?
This has been the Righteous Capitalist Podcast with Doug Zacher. To learn more, suggest a Righteous Capitalist for the show, or to subscribe, visit us at therighteouscapitalists.com or find us on all social media platforms with the handle Doug Zacher, the Righteous Capitalist Podcast, how we make money matters.
All right.